Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe.
Sponsored by Wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.
Hey everybody, I'm Larry Port. This is another episode of the Dream Job Cafe, and today I have with me my old friend, Mark Giuliano, who is a fire safety inspector. He's at the Broward Sheriff's Office Fire Rescue, and he's been a firefighter and been in this career for a long time. So Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Larry. Appreciate it.
You know, I'm like excited about this one because I feel like a lot of people who think about their career search are really only thinking about, like, you know, white collar work and office jobs. And I know that you've had a great career in the fire department. So I mean, but before we get started, I mean, like, you know, I know everybody has their preconceptions of what firefighters do, but what's your job like on a day-to-day basis? Like, what do you find yourself doing?
Okay, yeah. So been in the fire service now for I'm in my 22nd year. So I am currently a fire inspector, as Larry said. So my day-to-day job is quite different. I was on the trucks for 16 years. When I say the trucks, I was on the fire truck, on the ambulance, doing kind of the stuff that people, quote unquote, know the firemen do. So now on a day-to-day basis as a fire safety inspector, my main role is to, I go into all the businesses within my city. Our main task is to do their annual fire safety inspection, which we go in there and we check all the life safety systems. We check, you know, some of the little stuff like fire extinguishers and make sure they're not expired, make sure the exit signs are lit up. But then we get into much deeper aspects of life safety where you get into a restaurant. All their cooking equipment has to be under a specific hood suppression system and certified. So if there's ever a fire there, it doesn't burn the whole restaurant down and kill everyone inside, stuff like that. And then in bigger businesses, we check out their fire sprinkler systems or fire pumps, just all the systems that are going around the background to keep everyone safe while they're at work and going about their days, that it's all just existing. And this way you can go about your day knowing that if something happens in that building, the sprinklers are going to go off, the fire alarm is going to go off, and you know to get out.
Okay. So,
I know that's my new today.
Well, that's good. That makes total sense. Recently you've seen like crazy fires in the news, like the one in like Switzerland or something like that. It sounds like, mm-hmm. like they didn't have any of that stuff in place. So I could see how, these kind of things are critical from preventing those things from happening.
Yes. It's a little bit of a gimmick in our line of work, but we say everything starts in prevention, hence the name. But basically every fire code that we have in the books, which is NFPA, they write all the fire code nationwide. Any fire code that exists is unfortunately due to a tragedy that's happened.
Right.
They're all, this code exists now because on this unfortunate event that happened, whatever year it was, but historically through all the fire code, you can link almost every code back to tragic fire in 1957, tragic fire in 1970, collapse in 1980, all these different things. So besides that, my day-to-day now too, I also do plan review. So when a new building's being built or a renovation to a current building's being built, it gets submitted to us to look at the plans for all the life safety systems to make sure as this building's being built or the renovations are being done, all those things are up to code. So when the building is reopened or built and then occupied, it is safe.
Interesting. So you're like on this preventative side right now, but like, I guess you could call it before when you were on the trucks, like a reaction side. So what is that work like? Is it like okay. It is in the television shows or what's it like?
Okay. So yeah, that's television.
Dennis Leary stuff.
I mean, that was like, yeah, the Rescue Me that was on FX years ago. Now I think Chicago Fire's still on one of the channels. Remember the movie Backdraft?
Yeah, of course. Scott Glenn was that. I don't want to do any spoilers.
Well, no. Yeah. Don't do any spoilers, but he's actually, you think the poster would be, what's his face? Kurt Russell or something, whoever they want you to think it is. It's actually my friend. He was retired chief, not Chief Chicharonis. The silhouette and the poster is him.
Oh, good.
So he started consulting way back then on that show. And I think he still currently consults on Chicago Fire. Even with that, all the stories and things they show you are like very, very bloviated and usually very Hollywood, not very grounded in reality. We have, there are weird calls and crazy stuff, but most of the calls you do. So we're rewind a little bit. If you're a firefighter here in South Florida, we're as Larry knows, it's a fairly major metropolitan area. So everyone down here is cross-certified as also a paramedic. Every single person in the department, whether you're on a fire truck, a ladder truck, rescue truck, we call ambulances rescue trucks. Everyone's a firefighter paramedic. So no matter any, because down here, Larry also knows, South Florida is, our population is mostly skewed to the elderly still.
Yes.
88% of our calls that come in are medically related. So we, no matter what truck you're on, sometimes an ambulance isn't available. The fire truck's the closest truck to get there. So they will go first to a medical call if there's no rescue truck nearby, and the rescue truck will show up when they can. But to be more precise on what we do. So you get into a car accident, you're injured, someone else calls 911, you call 911, whatever, we show up. If you're stuck in the car, they call our extrication tools, jaws of life.
Right.
So those do come out. We don't use them every single call. Every time there's a car accident, we're not sitting there with they're actually called spreaders. We're not using those tools every time we get a car accident. Probably like 5% of car accidents we actually break those tools out on.
Okay.
But, you know, if there's multiple cars involved, we evaluate all the patients. We start to triage whoever's the worst affected. We go in that order, worst to least affected, start getting them triaged, assessed, and get them on rescue trucks to get them over to the hospital. And then on the way to the hospital, as soon as we get them in the back of the truck, we start treating them, or sometimes even on the scene. So if there's someone with some sort of a laceration or head trauma, blood, we stop the bleeding. If they have a spinal injury, we immobilize the spine, secure them to a backboard so they don't injure their spine further during the transport, load them on the truck, start IVs, give drugs if they need drugs, and get them to the hospital as fast as we can with the lights and sirens.
Gotcha. Do you put somebody like in the back of the ambulance with like a blanket around them and give them a cup of coffee like they do in every movie? Or is that?
Well, as Larry knows where we live, I mean, these past couple of days are maybe the exception, but most of our patients don't need blankets because it's very warm. But between every call, we clean the stretcher, we decon it thoroughly, we put a nice top sheet on it, we put an additional sheet and a blanket on top. So if for some reason the patient is cold, we will cover them with both layers if they need that.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So there's a lot of these calls are medical related. And like, how often, how frequently do you have your namesake? How actually do you have to respond to an actual fire and figure out how to put it out and whatever it is do?
So part of living down here and, you know, having had however many hurricanes we've had come through over the years, there's very, very few original like wood frame built homes. Mostly everything is concrete, block and steel up to the current Florida building code. So with that being said, usually most of our fires end up being room and contents, which means the stuff in the room and the contents of the room, concrete doesn't burn.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. So usually a regular house fire, it varies. There's not really any real fire season for us down here. Maybe we might get a dozen a week within the entire organization. You might get 20, we might get 5. That number varies very much. But when a fire does come in, we roll a big response here. Fire truck, ladder truck, hazmat truck, TRT truck, 2 rescue trucks, battalion chief, sometimes 2 battalion chiefs. And then everyone shows up. The first responding engine company, the first one there, first arriving unit, that captain on that engine will sort of do the initial size up and say, we have a single story residential family home. Smoke and fire showing from the C side of the structure, which is the rear of the structure. From the address side, it goes A, B, C, D around. That's how we look at it and letter it. And he'll say, initiating an initial fire attack. And his driver goes up on the pump panel, they stretch out their lines. The driver starts to charge up the lines. And the captain and his firefighter, based on where the fire is, they will go in and start doing a fire attack. And there's a good misconception I want to clear up with that too, that some people, especially with some of the Hollywood shows and movies and stuff, like, and not to be crass or crude, but if we pull up to a structure and there is just smoke and fire blowing out of every single window and the roof and every single part of the house, there's fire coming out of. And, you know, unfortunately you tell us, hey, you know, little Benji, the dog is inside. Unfortunately, little Benji, the dog is passed on now. And even if he wasn't, that's a defensive fire.
Like, okay.
We are not putting our bodies in there until we get the fire back down a whole lot from the outside before we then go into for interior attack.
So you guys have to make some tough calls and
yeah, that's kind of the thing. Like it's right. Our whole thing is risk a lot to save a lot.
Like, okay.
That scenario I just gave you with Benji. Mm-hmm. So that risk reward isn't there for us. Like if the fires, you know, we have a little bit of smoke coming out of one window and you tell us Benji's in there, we can go get Benji. But, you know, it's every time it's a judgment call as far as us making an educated decision of can we justify us going in and then putting all our lives in danger versus the reward we're going to get from doing that. Like there has to, if you tell us, oh, the house is empty, we're just going to start spraying water on from the outside until it's backed way down and until we finally go in. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the whole us rushing in every time, no matter what, every time is very, very, you know, for Hollywood.
Right.
Makes sense. We try to make it as logical of a response as possible, because like I said, we don't want to risk our lives if there's nothing to be gained. If here's another scenario, like we pull into that same fire coming at everything, every opening, every window. And unfortunately you're the homeowner. It's like, oh, I just built this house. It was $3 million. And, save my house. Like,
yeah,
we don't risk our lives to save someone else's just property. Right. You can't justify that. But as far as like fires go, a lot of people don't realize that we do have a very calculated way of doing things where certain things we might see from the outside. Like I mentioned, some of those conditions where we used to have fire coming out of everywhere. That's an unsafe environment for us, even with our gear on and hoses. We'll die in 10 seconds in that. And those types of, that's called a flashover condition where just everything's right. on fire. When you're seeing that fire come out like that, it's gotten so hot inside that the smoke and all the gas is actually on fire as well.
That's what they said happened in that Switzerland fire. Yeah, I didn't understand the science behind it, but you have things that you have to respond to. What percentage of your day are you kind of not doing that? And are you in a firehouse? Like, is that part
yes.
right? Like, is, okay.
So yeah, this is another good picture to paint for everybody. So I can't speak to the rest of the country. Every department sets their own, they set their own shift schedule or their own schedules. Typically down here in South Florida, we have a 24-hour on, 48-hour off. So one day on, 2 days off, that's our schedule.
Okay.
And so in a typical day, we'll just start from shift start to, we'll go through the whole shift. I think that's a good way to do it. So shift start 7 a.m., 8 a.m., it depends on the department, 7:30, 8:30, none of that really matters. But show up to shift, usually try to get there. The golden rule is get there a half hour early. To relieve, so if I'm on A shift, Larry, you're on B shift, you're my relief. You get there a half hour early before our shift ends in case the call comes in like quarter till, you hop on the truck for me so that I'm not stuck and I can go home.
Right, gotcha.
So that's kind of like a golden rule. Like the biggest, and I know it's kind of funny, especially like, you know, having worked in a few jobs beforehand, but being late is like the biggest faux pas in the fire service. It's like the cardinal sin. You cannot be late. So that's the first part of the shift. So we'll paint the picture. Like, let's say you're relieving me, Larry, I'm on A shift, you're on B shift, you're coming in. Before I leave, I'm sorry, hey, yeah, Larry, you know, busy day yesterday, ran a bunch of calls, had a fire, whatever, just give you a rundown, used a bunch of equipment on the truck, restocked everything. I might say, hey, we used all the Narcan yesterday. That's what we get for an overdose. Logistics was out. So the chief's going to try to get you some Narcan today. So just be ready to go pick up some Narcan or have him, he might drop some off. Just so you know, if you get an overdose, you're down Narcan, so you know that ahead of time. So we try to get the oncoming shift ready with any information like that. Same thing with the truck. Like, hey, it's been starting up a little funny. Maybe we find the rest of the shift. Maybe you got to go down the motor pool, get it checked out. You know, just whoever's relieving you to be fully prepared to whatever might have changed from the last time they were on the truck.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's step one. Then you check out your truck, depending on what spot in the truck you're on. If you're on the rescue truck, the driver of the rescue truck checks the oil, make sure all the tires have the right amount of pressure, all that little stuff. Then the guy, the medic in the back, they're checking to make sure all the drugs are in stock, any other extra equipment like gauze, band-aids, glucose strips for the checking people's blood sugar, all that kind of stuff, IV fluids, any other drugs. And then the lieutenant is going to go through the med kits and make sure all that equipment's there. They're going to make sure the computer's ready for, that's where they do all the reporting for the patients. And the fire truck does a very similar thing because usually every station has a fire truck and a rescue truck down here. So their crew is doing the same thing. Then everyone kind of runs through we clean up the inside of the station, clean up the barn. That's where we call the barn or the bay where you park the trucks. And then eat breakfast. And then after breakfast, most stations will either do in-house training or they'll go out and do training. or whatever the order is, doesn't really matter. But like, we might, like Larry, you might give a class on, hey guys, a new protocol came out with our advanced cardiac life support, where instead of doing how you shock the patient with it, with the defibrillator, they might change. These changes happen all the time. So if a little change comes out, you'll explain the new shocking system that we do for when we shock a patient. Give us a little class on that. And then
gotcha.
A lot of times we'll go out in the street with what my crew used to do. We would go, the rescue truck and the fire truck, we'd go out and we'd pick a building in our city, in our zone, and we call it a pre-plan. So we'd go to the building, let's say it's a 9-story apartment building, condo, and we're finding out where our standpipes are, our FDCs outside, which that's the FDCs are where we hook our hoses into that then charge up the standpipes, which if we're up in the stairwell, we hook our hoses to, and then we go down the hallway with our hoses. So we have water throughout the stairwell.
Wow. And, okay. This
we're trying to
make me feel better as like just someone who like lives in the area, how prepared you guys are. Like,
if I'm your fire station, I've been to your condo. If you live in a condo in my district, in my zone, I've been to your condo half dozen times, maybe a dozen times, just in a not emergency fashion to get to know the layout and be familiar with in case a fire or some other type of emergency happens there, that I know what I'm doing and know where I'm going. So we try to be as ready as possible. Now, a private home, a private single family home, obviously we don't do that. Just, you know, we can't go into someone's house.
Right.
But for any of the commercial properties that we can do that sort of pre-plan at, we try to, and we have a map of like, all right, we're, you know, over the course of the year, of course, we're going to pre-plan all these buildings. And, you know, sometimes we get to everyone every year. Sometimes it has to be every other year, but mm-hmm. we try to go to every single building and have an idea where we're going and what we're doing. So I said, no matter what kind of call comes in, we know what to do.
Well, this, what's interesting about this is for those that haven't like talked to any first responders before, or people that work in, for that matter, airlines or nursing and stuff like that, the shift schedules are very non-traditional. So you described it's 24 hours on and 40 hours off. So work one day and then rest two. What about vacation? Like, can you talk a little bit, like, do you typically get vacation? Is it like what most, you know, kind of corporate people get, which is like 2 to 3 weeks a year? Yeah. Is it more than that? What's it like?
Let's put a pin in that. Well, I'm going to get through the day real quick just so we don't forget, because almost done. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. Breakfast, go do the training. Training's 2 or 3 hours. That takes us to about 11 o'clock. We start thinking about lunch and dinner, because people don't understand this. A lot of times we get a lot of complaints, believe it or not, from the public. Why are those firemen always shopping?
You guys are always in our Publix.
So we're, now you understand a little better. We're on a 24-hour shift. Every crew we don't show up with groceries. So in the morning, we start to get a little bit of a game plan. We, you know, all right, here's what we want to eat for lunch. Here's what we're going to eat for dinner. We figure who's going to cook. They might look and see what's on sale, where. So around 11:30, 12 o'clock, they'll go buy lunch and procure whatever we want to cook for dinner. So that happens every single day for every single station, basically. So that's why you see so many firemen shopping at the grocery store every day, because we need to get food to eat. We got to feed ourselves. So after that point, once you're back at the station, and the other thing, overarching thing, while all this is going on, if a call comes in, we drop what we do and go right and run the call. So whatever I'm telling you. So that's always there. So if the bell rings, or if you're out and your radio goes off, you stop what you're doing and go respond to the call.
You leave the cart.
Yeah. I've done it hundreds of times in Publix. We leave the cart. They know, like, usually they have either a stock hand or a manager will come and they'll push it into one of the big walk-ins so we can come back and get it, because they know we will. But yeah, so once you're back, you then kind of the rest of the day is yours, to be, believe it or not. So you're at the station, but you're at that point around lunchtime. You can kind of do whatever you want. Some guys choose to sit down on the couch, lazy boy, and watch TV. Some guys will. I was a big workout guy. We have, every station had at least mostly a full gym. So I would work out for sometimes 2-3 hours a day, just because with the job, the more fit you were, the less wear and tear the job had on your body, because you were able to be more resilient from all the wear and tear. But so work out up until dinner time, eat dinner, take a shower, do one last round of station duties. You button up whatever reports that you did for that day, whether rescue reports or fire reports, get all this buttoned up. Everything gets sent off to the chief at like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And then same thing again, it's kind of like shut it down. You can hang out with the boys, watch movies. Some people would go to sleep early, but that's kind of the day. And this crew you're with, they become your second family, because you're with these people 100 days a year, 24 hours at a time. And usually for years at a time, you're with the same crew. So These are your buddies. These are your family. So some cases with younger guys, they would bring in like an Xbox or a PlayStation and play Call of Duty on the TV during their downtime. But the downtime is whatever you want it to be. It's like if your training's done and there's no extra work to be done that day, it's right. considered downtime. And you could just, whatever you want to do to kill the time, you just need to be ready to respond, period. So, and yeah, having painted out the day, 9, 10 o'clock, everyone goes to bed. Wake up an hour before shift ends.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Is it like army barracks or do you have your own room or what is it like?
So all the newer stations, I would say anything built after like 2005, private cubicle for every single person. So we still have some legacy stations that are kind of set up like army barracks is kind of a good way to paint the picture. Just we've since like tried to add like curtain dividers wherever we can, but it was very much like army barracks, just beds and lockers in an open room. But yeah, especially now that there are so many more women in the fire service, having private quarters and private bathrooms is much more of a thing for when stations are built and they're considered now, where stations that were built 50 years ago that wasn't considered.
Right.
They try to retrofit that as much as they could, but some buildings you just can't retrofit. But yeah, so you go to sleep at night and then you wake up an hour before shift change. And then we get back to where I told you, like then whoever's on C shift is coming to relieve me. I'm getting ready to go home, packing up my stuff. You know, if you have a bid at that station, you don't have much stuff there because you keep it mostly in your lockers. So I had like one bag to pack up because I had a bid at a station and throw it in my truck. And whenever my relief got there, you know, shake hands, high five, tell them what's going on and go home. And then based on your station, where you're at, every district is busier or slower. So if you're at a slow station, you might only run 5 calls. If you're at a busy station, might run 15 calls, 50. Might run 20 calls.
Yeah.
So there's no rhyme or reason to that. Like, you know, certain districts are just busier. Like you have some of your stations that have like the I-95 corridor or the Turnpike mm-hmm. corridor. Those are highways for anyone that's not from around here. But yeah, those get a lot more car accidents. So around early morning rush hour, afternoon rush hour, those stations get a little more busier with accidents because there's more cars on the road.
But I remember I remember seeing this in the newspaper. I'm not sure if like you or the people that you worked with were interviewed, but at the height of the opioid epidemic, like you guys were responding to like 8-12 calls a day of like overdoses. Yeah. I don't know if it's hopefully it's died down, but really afflicting Delray.
Yeah. All of South Florida was getting hit hard with, because the Delray, beautiful beach town, it's a very appealing place for someone to open up a drug rehab.
Yeah, there's a lot of them there.
That's basically all of South Florida. So real quick, we'll just go over this because it was such a big thing nationwide. The rehabs, they pull in the people that go into rehab, people wash out of rehab, and then that's what they're in that area for a while. And it's predatory, where the drug dealers know that, and they set up shop all here in South Florida. So the drugs are really available for when the people unfortunately leave rehab and they had clientele ready to go. And yeah, that's kind of how the rehab thing worked and why it's kind of a vicious cycle. It's like for the drug dealers, it's a constant source of people that want to do drugs, unfortunately. So, yeah.
But yeah, and so just so people know, it's like, you know, the people that were on the front line of that one were you guys. It was like the fire department.
Right? Yeah. And what you said was very much a thing that was happening. So just for people that don't understand, our number one, or really our only drug that we have to in defense of or offense of opiates is a drug called Narcan. And it basically, if this is an opiate receptor, and then the drug goes to this receptor, the actual narcotic drug, like the heroin, the fentanyl. What Narcan does is it has a greater affinity to bond with this receptor and push out the bad drug. But fentanyl has a much stronger bond than, say, what's called classic heroin did.
Right,
so,
okay.
So the fentanyl grabs on stronger, is more potent, and it just took so much more Narcan to negate the actual fentanyl that we were using some 3-4, sometimes 5 times as much Narcan on one patient than we ever had to use before. So until we were, it took us like a year to really understand, like, is this for people don't realize, like, this kind of started back in like 2014. That's when I started seeing fentanyl overdoses. Some people,
no,
because I was on the front line. So most people, like, it was new to me, but you know, everyone outside of our line of work, they didn't really know about it just yet.
Right. But
That year, like 2013, 2014 is when we started, okay, we only have six milligrams of Narcan on the truck. Well, now we got to stock 20 milligrams of Narcan in the truck. Gotcha. And sometimes we would still go through that in one day. Cause you, like you said, you would have I remember a shift. I ran 9 overdoses in one day just in my zone.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I think that's the point is that you're going to have to like respond to a variety of different things, but there's also, it could alternate between like this, like kind of intense activity, but also like kind of the chill vibe of the firehouse.
Right? Yeah. I mean, as yin and yang is you're dead asleep to, you know, there's a 2-alarm fire, condos on fire, you know, actively evacuating people. At 3 in the morning, you're going from 0 to 100. And yeah, that type of, you know, the adrenaline is nice in that moment because it does, you know, kind of does wake you up and get you going. But
right. And you're not allowed to stop can you stop at Starbucks on the way to a 2-alarm fire, or is that like frowned upon?
Okay. Yeah, it's typically frowned upon. Yeah. We're good about that down here. We typically have a six minute or less response time from when someone calls 911, which is like top in the nation for response time. So
oh, wow.
That even, Larry, right now, if something was happening to you or your family, that 6 minutes would still feel like a lifetime. Like, even though as fast as it is, it still feels like forever. So, like, yeah. The faster we get to people, no matter, we're always looking for ways to improve response time. So, that's
interesting.
With a lot of medical stuff, too, even with fires, like with medical stuff, a heart attack, a stroke, we always, the cliche term we use and that side of things is time is muscle, time is brain. So The quicker if someone has a heart attack, the quicker we get to doing CPR, more and less heart muscle we're going to save. Same thing if they have a bad stroke, the quicker we get the care they need, the more of the brain we're going to save if we actually can start reversing that stroke. And they're going to have, whether it's a heart attack or a stroke, they're going to have much less deficits, if hopefully none, by the time we intervene and get them to the hospital. So the faster we get, and same thing with a fire, the faster you call us when something is fire, the less time it has to burn and intensify. So response times are huge.
Gotcha. But tell me about, did you want to do this since you were a kid, or how did you end up in this line of work?
Okay. This is good. This is going to bring me back to the last question you asked, where I wanted to keep talking about the day to day. So when I was a kid, zero aspirations of being a fireman or a firefighter. I kind of wanted to get into, you know, I was born in 1984, the year of Nintendo. So I grew up like one of the first generations really exposed to video games and loved video games. I played sports and everything too, but I thought I was going to go to college and become a software developer and make video games. That's what I love video games. That's what I want to do. So happy I never got into that. That I was fortunate enough to dip my toe into those waters of that industry and see how crazy and cutthroat it is. And, you know, people don't realize about that industry, but like, you know, you can make a AAA video game and you were working on it for 3 or 4 years. And then the publisher's like, all right, thanks for your work.
Adios.
See you later.
Yes.
Great job.
Right.
You're laid off. Yeah. So I love video games. Some of the stuff we're going to talk about, I wish would happen in that industry, as we'll get there. But yes, to get back to the question. So I thought I was going to be a software engineer of some kind. That's what I was going to go to school for. While I was in college and through high school, one of my first jobs was a lifeguard, which kind of dipped my toe in this whole public service world. And which eventually was what introduced me to the people that would introduce me to this line of work. But I was in college. I was a freshman in college. I just got in my second semester at FAU. And I was complaining to a couple of my lifeguard coworkers that like, yeah, you know, they were sitting seeing me. I was studying for whatever class it was. It was probably like college algebra or something. I hate math, you know, so I was like, you know, stupid. And they're like, oh, that sucks. Well, we're going to be firemen. We don't got to worry about college. I was like, you're going to be firemen. Like, what is... All right, like, what do they do? Like, you know, besides the obvious stuff that we see on TV, like fires, right. You know, you want to put them out, this and that. And so they kind of started explaining to me, like, they told me about the day I just explained. They're like, oh, yeah, it's really cool. You know, like, you know, you run the calls and they're a lot of fun. And I mean, you come back to the station, you kind of just hang out with your buddies and do whatever you want and this and that, train, blah, blah, blah. And then they started telling me a little bit about, like, the benefits. They're like, oh, they have really good benefits for health and retirement and they get paid pretty good, believe it or not. And then they told me about the schedule. So the schedule was a big thing because, you know, here I am at the time. I was in freshman in college going to college full time at the time. I was working like 60, 70 hours a week. I had 3 jobs. I have 2 lifeguarding jobs. And I worked at, we all remember the place. I worked at Ritz Camera store. Okay. We don't have it.
All right.
Those don't exist anymore. I'm just, you know, just grinding, you know, grinding myself into like nothing. But then they started telling me like, yeah, they work 24 hours straight and then they're off for 48 hours. I'm like, wait, so they work one day and then they're off for 2? And they're like, yeah, on top of that, they get this thing called the Kelly Day. I'm like, what's a Kelly? That's a made up thing. They're like, well, I'll try to explain it the best I can, but a Kelly day is most departments that have the 24-48 rotation. Every shift, you earn 4 hours towards your Kelly day. So
okay.
After six shifts, the seventh day is your Kelly day. You've earned 24 hours, one, two, three, four, five, six. That's 4 hours a shift, 24. The seventh shift is your Kelly day. So, and when this happens is it works out to be the same day. So my Kelly day was Saturday. So it was, which was beautiful because I knew every Saturday I was off. And not only was I was off for 5 days in a row.
Wow.
So we didn't get into this. Larry and me know each other from playing Ultimate Frisbee. It was mostly on Sundays, but for a long, long time, I was off every Saturday. I would go play Ultimate Frisbee with another crew way back. You know, this is going like back to like 2011. But yeah, I was off every single Saturday. And to get back to your question too, as far as like you were starting to get into like a PTO and vacation days and holidays, with that schedule, you end up working about 109 days a year scheduled.
Right.
So 109 minus 364, I'm bad at math, 255.
Okay, yeah. Let's call it.
Right?
I can't think right now.
I think so. You're scheduled off 255 days a year.
Right. That's a lot.
And that's before vacation.
Oh, you have vacation.
Yeah. So
okay.
It starts off, I think, in a week. And then, and this is another aspect we're going to get back into, but because of collective bargaining, everything kind of works. And when I say collective bargaining, that means we're in a union. We'll get back to that. But when you first start, you might have a week of vacation, then that builds to 8 days, 9 days. And then by the time you're topped out, you usually have like 2.5, 3 weeks of vacation. Like right now, I get 160 hours of vacation a year.
Okay. Gotcha.
Like, I'm topped out. But to answer your question, so 255 scheduled days off, then about 160 days of PTO vacation days you can plug in wherever you want. And every mm-hmm. so, and my
160 time, hours, right?
100 hours. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Every time you plug in a 24-hour shift of PTO, 5 days off. That's kind of cool.
That's right? Nuts.
That's pretty cool. So the best I ever did was I went to South America when I was 24. I was off for like 63 days paid.
That's insane.
Because if you take like 7 days off, then you could, so you take that third day. So you have the 2 days off and then that third day, you can take that as a PTO day. Then you have another 2 days. So every time you have a day off, you have 5 days off.
Yes. And
wow.
And so on top of regular PTO, and there's other things we do. So this, and I think this is important because this is a selling point for the job. Cause
yeah, for sure.
Our job is hard. But it's also rewarding in multiple ways. And this is the schedule is one of them. So I'm on A shift, you're on B shift. I say, we're on the same truck, same station. We're like, I had a go-to guy. That was our situation. He was my guy. I would go talk to you, say, all right, Larry, I need next Sunday off. Can you work for me? Sure. And then you say, I need this random Friday off, whatever month. So we set it up ahead of time. You're going to work my Sunday. I'm going to work your Friday. So through shift exchanges too, you can stack up a bunch of time off. Or if you're my go-to guy or I'm vice versa, like I'll just work a day for you and you owe me.
Gotcha.
And I know I can trust you because ultimately people are accountable and they have to pay you back.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I say pay you back, they have to work the day for you at some point, but you shouldn't have to go outside of just talking to the person face-to-face to schedule that.
Right. Gotcha.
But you can't get screwed out of it. Like that's what I'm trying to say. If you have to involve administration to get them to pay you back, you can. But I've had me and my go-to guy, like I owe him, he'd have 5 days in the shoot that he owed me, vice versa. And, you know, if you, hey, you know, and then, you know, you try to go out of your way, like, can you work this day for me? Sure. I'll work that day. I mean, obviously if you have something going on, they understand, but it's between that and the PTO. And then you could also do some departments you can actually trade Kelly days. So if I have a Saturday and you have a Sunday, like, you can work it out to like, I'll give you my Saturday this month, but you'll get your Sunday over here. There's a lot of different stuff you can do. We had guys that would be off the entire summer. They'd be off for like 4 months in a row.
Oh my gosh. That's incredible. Yeah. Let me ask you this. Who's like a great fit for this kind of role? Like what kind of personality traits or habits or whatever? And like, who should absolutely not consider this kind of a job, do you think?
So someone that's good for this job, I would say if you're physically active and you like helping people, that's really the core of this job is we are public servants. So if you're the kind of person that when someone needs help or is in trouble, you don't feel compelled or want to help them, this may not be for you. We'll get the obvious things out of the way. If you can't handle blood and gore, it's not going to be the job for you. If for some reason you're scared of the fire side of the job, it's not going to be the job for you. Those things, more the medical stuff, but like, one of the things I would recommend, I want to make sure I plug this again, almost nationwide, I hate to throw a percentage out there, but most departments have a fire cadet or fire explorer program for teenagers. And they even have some for like younger adults. But that, I recommend everyone to try to enter those programs so they can eventually do a ride along, because that's kind of like your free pass, your free all exclusive pass to see what goes on at the fire department. Mm-hmm. So if you can't handle blood and gore, you're going to run on calls and you're going to see blood and gore. You're going to find out if you can handle blood and gore. If you think a car accident and cars whizzing by on 95 is scary and you don't want to, you might not be able to, you're going to be on 95 with cars whizzing by.
Right.
So it'll expose you to everything. Minus, our cadets can't go into a fire. They'll go to a fire scene and they'll hang out at the chief's car and help hand him things, but they can't, obviously a teenager's not going to go into a fully involved structure fire. But I would recommend everyone do that step to expose themselves to the actual work. And then on the next layer beyond that is the schooling, EMT school, paramedic school, fire academy. Those are all going to directly expose you to almost everything you're going to have to be exposed to. So
are those things expensive, or does that paid for you, or how does that work?
So yes and no. Some departments still do that. I believe Metro Dade, which is part of Miami, they'll hire a 18-year-old Larry Port off the street. If you have a good record, that's important to have a good record. You don't, no arrests, no driving, no bad driving history. Yeah, be a good kid. But right. They'll hire you as long as you submit the application, whatever the requirements are. But they will hire someone, Joe Nobody, off the street and put them through all the schooling. They're one of the only departments I believe still do that. They may not even do that anymore. I don't want to speak out of turn, but they used to do that. But most of the departments down here, you need to be at least a firefighter EMT. And most of them down here, you have to be a firefighter paramedic. EMT school is one semester of college and or about 3 months of school. Fire academy is about 3 months full-time or about 6 months part-time. Part-time would be nights and weekends, so you could work a full-time job and attend the fire academy. And then paramedic school is on paper about 4 semesters of college, so about 16 months.
But so there is a fair degree of schooling.
When I went through, I got hired as just an EMT. I was in paramedic school, but I had been through only 6 months of schooling by the time I got hired.
Gotcha.
We hired EMTs back then, and we had to sign the contract stating we would become paramedics, which I did within a year.
Is it hard to hire people? Like, do you have a shortage of people? Like, are you looking for people?
So right now, we down here in Florida, I can only speak to Florida. I don't know the nationwide statistics, but we are in a shortage, I think, for the first time in a while. But mm-hmm. our attrition rate of people retiring is not, our hiring rate is not outweighing that right now. There's no equivalence. We're behind. My department's a big department. We're about 1,000 people. And we're only doing about 2 classes of hires a year, which is about 20 people a class, if we're lucky. And all those don't make it through. But so, we're not keeping up with the trend. So we are constantly a little short of people, and we need more people to do these jobs, which I think the beautiful part about this is more education about what these jobs are. People don't understand that you can, 20 years old, that's a fairly, if you start after high school, you could probably get in before 20 if you go right into everything and all the schooling. But you could be 19, paramedic. And your first year with overtime, you'll make $100,000.
It's amazing.
More in a lot of cases.
So there's there's real potential for like six-figure work here.
And one of the things I wanted to get back to as well is unlike, let's say you go, whatever, you go to school, get a marketing degree and end up at some firm. You're an at-will employee. You're not protected. Most departments, we're unions. We're union-based employees. We're under collective bargaining agreements that our union negotiates for us. But our whole contract's laid out. So I know I have 11 raises on the contract from the day I get hired that I know I'm going to get.
Wow.
I get years 1 through 8, year 12, year 15, year 18, year 20. Like, no matter what happens, I get all those raises throughout my career.
the other thing that's interesting is that, like, we were talking a little bit before we started recording that, like, my wife has this cousin and she married a fireman, and he's doesn't seem like he's that much older than me, or maybe he's my same age, but he's retired and they're living on a boat and sailing around the Caribbean, and that's where they live. That's their life. So talk a little bit about, like, retirement, because you can, it seems like it's not like you're not 65.
No. Right? Yeah. So most apartments, they have a defined benefit pension system, which the media, unfortunately, I think these days they tend to vilify it more than actually be honest about what it is. The pension fund is a conglomerate of money that every employee pays into, and also the employer will pay a small portion in some cases. My pension that I have from the city of Deerfield Beach is about 95% funded by the pension. The money keeps growing to pay the pensions. The city pays in very low money to keep it fiduciarily sound. And basically those pensions, depending on the actual pension, sometimes it's 20 years, sometimes it's 25 years, but you work 20 years typically and you're guaranteed an 80% pension. So 80% meaning 80% of your calculated three best years, right? Or 60%, it depends on calculations and stuff. I think 60% is more of the 20-year pensions, but without getting too much into the nuts and bolts of that, just basically, if you work 20 years, you work 25 years, most people these days are walking away with either six figures or close to six figure pensions that they get a monthly stipend and annual salary for the rest of their life without working. So a lot of today's youth are big into this whole financial independence, retire early. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Nothing to do with the fire department either. This is just a movement.
But the fire department is an avenue to it. If you want, you get
that
hired at 19, you do 25 years. If you have a 25 year pension, you're 44 years old and you can have, I know people that are walking with pensions for $130,000, $140,000, $150,000 a year. And
that's
on
a lot.
Top of that, Larry knows this. I'm sure you mentioned this throughout some of your other guests, but you know, we don't just rely on the pension. You know, I have it's called the 457 plan. It's basically it's a 401k for first responders. So I have hundreds of thousands of dollars in that I've been contributing to for my whole career. And I let that keep growing. You know, my wife has one too. So, you know, I'm not going to have just this pension. We're also going to, the things that we call them civilians, normal people, the things that normal people have, we don't neglect those too. We take advantage of those programs as well. So we just have, like, the pension as being this thing that, without getting too far into it, but like, I believe $100,000 a year draw is like equivalent to having like $1 million in the bank. Something like $2 million, I think.
Well, it's also like you don't have to worry about running out of it. Like, I think for a lot of people who retire, and also in the world we live in now, people are living longer, and that's a major concern for a lot of people. I mean, people just starting out, they're not even conceiving of that, but there does come a time where you stop working and you have to think about how you're going to fund your life. Well, look, Mark, I think I'm about out of time here. I mean, I would love to speak with you more about this. There's just so much to explore. And I really do think, though, that it's a very good avenue for people who just don't want to have, like, kind of a Dilbert life, you know?
Yes.
Like, if you have a sense of adventure in your life, if you want a lot of, like, time off and freedom. Also, the one thing you mentioned is that, like, it seems like you really should be able to get along with people if you're going to be, you know, like, kind of like in a battalion, like with these...
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, when you're on shift, you're with it depends on how many trucks are at the station, 6 guys to 15 guys sometimes, all in one little firehouse on top, you know, not on top of each other, but you're with these people day in, day out, you know, all day long, responding to stressful situations with these people. It's being a sociable person that can, you know, be dynamic and flexible is important to get along with all the different personalities. Is whatever personalities you deal out there in any other career, any other part of life, all those personalities are in the fire department too. So it's good to be equipped with those skills. Another thing I think we didn't think to talk about too is I think the fire department is, and the schedule namely, is what I'm seeing more of now. It is allowing people to treat it as a career, be very serious about it, but with all the time off, if they have a passion project or a passion business idea, you have the money to do it. You have the time to do it. You know, you see a lot of people, like, that's another thing they might say, if they're I'm stuck in a career. You know, they don't have the time, mainly the time. they're working 40 hours a week. Maybe they're working a bunch of overtime. Maybe they're working 60 hours a week. They don't have time to pursue a passion project. You're like, oh, you know, I had this great idea for an Etsy store. You know, I make this thing in my wood shop and I can sell them, but I just don't have the time to do it. So we have a lot of guys. We have a guy, I think he's done like 5 ultra successful Kickstarters.
That's really
millions
funny.
Millions of dollars.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you have people like, yeah, because I was thinking, geez, if I had that time and when I started
if you watch the news, I see his commercials are on the news every day.
That's so funny. No, first I mean, product. When I started my software company, I was, you know, working nights and weekends and I was dying and having a full-time job, that wasn't entirely possible. Eventually I had to take a major risk and quit my job. So this is the kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where,
think about what you did. If you,
yeah. Yeah, I could have done this.
You had a stable backbone and you could have pursued X amount of tries. You could just keep trying and until you've succeeded, because you had the backbone of the fire department there always to rely on. You know, it's a very interesting thing where people don't, like I said, there's the education of what this job really all entails isn't out there. So hopefully we've educated people a little bit that it's not just what you see on Chicago Fire. It's not these crazy calls with the wildest situations. It's, we train, we run calls, we help people, and
we chill.
You chill at the station and hang out with your buddies.
All right. Well, this is great. Hopefully this has inspired some people to maybe take a look at this as a career. That would be really exciting. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Appreciate it.
For those of you out there, if you like this podcast, please like it and subscribe to it and tell your friends about it. That's the best way for us to grow. And if you can, please be grateful for something today.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Dream Job Cafe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to check out wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.